You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, I'm Kat Rosenfield.
And I'm Phoebe Maltz-Bovey, and this is a special dress-wearing edition of Feminine Chaos. And we are going to talk about a whole bunch of things today, as usual. But we are going to begin with the topic of artificial intelligence, which I have heard of before, and which Kat knows about more than I do, although we'll discuss it, both of us, a bit. And specifically an article that everybody's talking about these days in Wired, about artificial intelligence and dating and the research on this and why artificial intelligence can be everybody's favorite term, problematic. Kat, what's the deal with artificial intelligence and dating and problematicness?
Well, it turns out that when you try to create an algorithm that will allow people to connect with other persons of their, you know, who they find desirable via an app, the algorithm will internalize whatever biases human beings carry around in general. At least sometimes, you know, debatable whether you can then say that the app or the algorithm itself is biased. Like, you know, is this artificial consciousness racist the way that a person would be? But it's created kind of an ethical dilemma for people who are designing these apps and for the, you know, for the apps themselves or the sites that are using them, on something like, it depends on, you know, if it's Grindr or Tinder or Hinge or Bumble or whatever. Some of them allow you to select for ethnicity specifically. So, you know, it obviously the idea of somebody being able to enforce a racial preference in their dating life by like clicking a little box that eliminates certain people from the dating pool strikes some people as being potentially problematic.
And potentially more problematic than the sort of unstated preferences that everybody has, whether they're racial or not, in dating, where, you know, it's the rare person who's going to get on the bus and think that they'd be equally interested in dating in every single person they see on the bus, all, you know, every adult they see on the bus, all ages, genders, every body type, everything. It's unlikely that there's somebody who's going to get on the bus and want to date everyone equally.
Right. Well, so the fact that it requires being explicitly stated and explicitly selected seems to be where the line gets crossed for a lot of people. You know, it's, if you have a racial preference and you just don't say it out loud, that seems to be kind of more accepted.
I think what's strange, I mean, with dating in general, I guess, it seems to me that if you work backwards from consent being the starting point, nobody can be forced to consider dating even anybody, any individual they don't want to date. And if you sort of take that as your starting point, it's never like you can land with individuals with very exclusionary tastes. And then the issue there isn't so much like, and I'm talking about pre-internet, you know, the issue there is not so much that they are exclusionary and unfair as that they're generally going to be just limiting themselves, especially like if some, take the sort of classic cliched situation. Let's say a man will only date women who look like supermodels. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's exclusionary, but it's chances are, unless there's anything particular about this man, supermodels aren't interested in him. He's just stuck. You know what I mean?
Right. Unless he looks like a supermodel himself.
Exactly.
Or the male version thereof.
Exactly.
But yeah, I mean, once you start trying to, in any way, kind of like morally legislate, morally legislate what people are attracted to and to try to make it conform to any kind of, like a moral value system. I mean, it's not just that you end up, you know, trying to kind of, you establish something that kind of negates consent. But eventually you start running into territory where it's like, you know, how thinly or how broadly can you slice it? You know, is it problematic for a, you know, for instance, you know, for a lesbian, who likes women to not want to date trans women who don't have the, you know, necessarily the type of body that they're attracted to?
Well, I think in cases like this, which is sort of, that's like the classic fraught case of these days. Mm-hmm. I think the sort of, I guess this is where the AI versus just dating in general sort of conundrum falls into it. I guess where I've always fallen on this is there's a, like anything goes when it comes to an individual's actual preferences, because, mm-hmm. you know, I think everybody has the right to exclude the entirety of humanity if they want from their dating pool, you know, or somebody's asexual and aromantic and so forth and just not into dating, they're allowed. It's exclusive. It's exclusionary, but it's fine, you know. Mm-hmm. But then I think where exclusionary behavior can come into it and where it does kind of make sense to talk about where bigotry could enter into it is when people announce their preferences. So I think if, and with the caveat about lanes and this being not mine and all the different levels, I think, you know, it's different if a lesbian if a specific lesbian does not want to date trans women, then if a specific lesbian tells random trans women she meets apropos of nothing who have no reason to be involved with her romantically, who she meets like at work, that she, just so you know, would not date trans women, then I think that's like, that's its own thing, because I think it's bringing the sort of dating judgment sphere into other spheres. And I think that then that where I think the AI angle might enter into it, or the app angle, with the, again, another caveat that I have no personal firsthand experience with apps of any kind. I just, you know, typewriter now, of these sort of apps. But it seems like you're kind of having to announce preferences, even, but you're not announcing them outside of the dating realm. So it's sort of this, yeah.
Right, so context matters a lot, is what you're saying.
Right. And I think it's the same thing. I mean, if somebody, I say this as you all feminine chaos viewers know, as a Jewish woman, if somebody wouldn't date Jews, that's just their thing. I mean, that's, you know, that's for them to feel, you know, I would suggest they not try J-date. But it's different for me if somebody feels that way than if somebody were to tell me apropos of nothing, just so you know, because you're Jewish, I would never have considered dating you. You know, that would be like different.
And on an interpersonal level, and this kind of comes back to something that I was, you know, always running up against as an advice columnist formerly now, which is that, you know, at the end of the day, you really do not want to be dating somebody who doesn't want to date you, and whatever their reasons for not wanting to date you, I mean, it almost doesn't matter what the specifics are, because the fact that they don't want to date you for any reason should automatically exclude them from your pool of desirables. Like, at base,
the person
that you want should want you.
Conversely, but also the fact that somebody will date or perhaps even seeks out people of other groups or specific other groups to date doesn't necessarily mean that this is the world's most tolerant person. There's fetishization, there's making exception for one person but still being very bigoted. These things exist. It comes up a lot in my super fascinating dissertation on 19th century France that I'm not going to talk about further now, but this is an old story that people could like an individual of a group but maybe still hate the group. So there's really, I feel like these are just different realms. Mm-hmm. And to try to imagine that there's some direct relationship between people's dating preferences and their politics, just, it's much more complicated.
Right. So to return to the AI thing, thing that was interesting to me, and I don't have actually like a solution on this. I just have like a lot of, you know, God, this is really crazy and interesting to talk about, is that people were being, even if they didn't necessarily explicitly say that they wanted to date people only of their own race, that the algorithms were serving up just people of their own race because they, you know, were able to look at like, you know, who are you generally associated with, or, you know, what do we think you're going to like? And I think it's, you know, it's just such a conundrum, really, to when we design these apps to do, you know, cognitive and like emotional tasks for us. What ultimately is it that we want them to do? Like, do we want them to give us what we want, you know, to facilitate the same kind of choices and decision making that we would have come to on our own if we were doing it the old fashioned way? Or do we want the apps to do work to make us like better people than we are without them? Like, do we want the app to serve us what we should want, not what we do want?
Well, I think this is super fascinating as well, and the AI aspect of it. I mean, just as we've been talking now, I've just been thinking about how this is similar, not that we're going to go down this path today a ton, but to fiction. And like, what do you want out of fiction? Do you want it to describe the world as it actually is, or do you want it to create a better world? And in a way, that's kind of what's happening here. It's kind of similar dynamics to that. But also, this question of what it is we want from AI as versus what it's doing for companies. And I mean, just to go with an example or a couple of examples of things that I'm personally familiar with, so I don't really know what they bring up in terms of dates on an app. But I do know what they bring up in terms of like a pair of shoes that they will show you that you looked at weeks ago and you keep seeing this ad. Is it because I want to keep seeing these sneakers I looked at and decided not to buy weeks ago? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Things like that. Or on a more sort of fraught, or not fraught, on a more like emotionally charged potentially level, something like with Facebook where the algorithms will decide who you're going to hear about all the time. And it's this random group of people.
Yeah, it's not who you want to hear about.
Not who you want to hear about. It's not necessarily who you don't want to hear about. I don't want to, you know, it's not that the list of five people Facebook has decided I think are fascinating. Are none of them interesting? They're just like for these five people, and I don't even know why. And I think it has, and that's what it's this way it shapes experience. Where conversely, so I'm not doing a whole lot with Facebook these days, but when I would use it more, I would find that friends who had left Facebook and who didn't live in the same city as I did, it's easy to lose track of people. And then that's the aspect of this that kind of I find unnerving, is how it can. How it sort of can shape your experience in that way. And with the dating apps specifically, it's my impression that, especially with Me Too, but even before, that it's become much more taboo to meet people, not in all other offline realms, but certainly, I mean, there have been articles written about like the end of the gay bar and also just, sort of the end of picking someone up in a public space and that being necessarily considered okay. Certainly dating at work is fraught. So then if apps are what you're forced to use.
I was stunned to, you know, to hear that. And I guess it makes sense, but it makes me so relieved personally that I, you know, met and married somebody before the rise of smartphones, you know, before they were like the big thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, but I think that really raises the stakes here because it's like, it's not just, oh, well, fine, so don't use apps. It seems like, but you can't, if you want to meet people, it seems like you almost have to now.
Right, you have to play by whatever rules are, you know, are reigning within the context of that app.
So it matters a lot. It sounds so niche to talk about like, oh, well, these apps, but it's like, but that's just, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think if it's really exacerbating existing biases, then that is a problem. And there, I guess it doesn't seem like there'd be any neutral way this could play out. You know, either it's going to be, yeah, it seems like it's always going to be engineering experience in one way or another. Like, I don't know how that could be avoided.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's like, is it exacerbating existing biases or is it just reproducing them the same way that, you know, that they exist in the wider world, but because we're seeing them in this kind of explicit context, we find them disturbing in a way that we don't when it's just happening sort of more organically. I mean, I don't know. One of the kind of tangents to this question of, you know, allowing AI to, you know, or allowing bots or algorithms to make choices for us or should like present us with choices to make, is what the bots believe in terms, like what they see as beautiful, how they define the idea of beauty. And, you know, there was this experiment where a bunch of people fed like faces into a neural net and then asked people to submit their own photos, and the bot judged who was the most beautiful, and it only picked like one black person and everybody else was white or Asian. And the question was, you know, was this an act of racism? Was it a design flaw? Was it something unconscious? Or was it a question of, you know, they had used like an American selection of faces to begin with, and so they fed certain proportions of, you know, different, like different races were represented in proportion to like their actual presence in the US population. And that's why the bot assumed that like beautiful people tend to look, you know, whiter.
I guess the bot, the idea of a bot assessing beauty seems so strange because it just seems a bit circular somehow. Cause like,
right.
You have to somehow teach it what is considered beautiful in this society, and how would it not just reproduce? Like, it's not going to say, you know, actually, like, you know, 90-year-old women are the most sought after,
right,
in the society.
And what's interesting is, like, you can ask, I mean, you could make this purely a question of math. You know, you could feed faces into a program and say, like, analyze, you know, these different ratios, you know, analyze the skin for like these different blemishes. And
but does that actually get to what people would find?
This is the question. It's like, you know, even if we agreed, like, okay, we're going to let the bot decide because the bot, you know, it's pure math, like it's not going to be afflicted by bias, are we all going to be able to adjust our internal kind of compass for what we consider beautiful to whatever the bot spits out?
Right. I mean, I don't think there is a pure math way of thinking about beauty. I think it just doesn't work like that, I guess. And I don't know whether it's just that the bots aren't sophisticated enough to figure out how it does work, but it's also, it's that offline. And I think this gets back to kind of this AI versus, old school, human interaction, I guess, that in dating in the offline world, the way it is or was, you don't know which boxes someone would have ticked. Mm-hmm. And it just allows for more, you know, more variance, I guess. And this seems like pushing towards a situation where, kind of encouraging everyone maybe to want the same thing, potentially, or to value the same thing. I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, certainly it pushes for more to, everybody sees everybody, I think, is maybe more the difference. That, like, it's one thing to go for the person who's the most attractive at the party, but then to go for the person who's the most attractive on an app, it's just a whole different number of people.
Right, right. And I mean, who you find attractive on paper because they tick a certain number of boxes, not necessarily who, if you're out at a party in person and, you know, you are in the same room and you get to experience that person's physical presence, like what you might end up liking. Or, I mean, I don't know, I'm just thinking about, like, personally, my husband and I are diametrically opposed in a lot of ways. Like, he likes the Red Sox, which, you know, back when I was dating, I would have been like, absolutely not. but, you know, like all of these boxes that, you know, had I been on an app, I would have gone ahead and been like, nope, 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 because, you know, it's easy to eliminate these people who in a surface kind of way seem like they're going to be incompatible with you. You know, you end up missing that ephemeral thing that doesn't fit into a box.
Right. I mean, there are all sorts of qualities that just, if you interact only with people online, especially only in like with just a few photos and some text, you really, like somebody's mannerisms could be really odd, or, you know, or they could like smell really bad, or I don't know.
Right. Or they just smell really bad to you.
To you. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. I mean, it's interesting because like the fact is, you know, bots are not good at, they're not even that good at like figuring out what kind of movies you're going to like. When I think about the stuff that Netflix suggests to me.
Netflix has a lot of notions for me that are, but it's weird. It's like, it feels like it's revealing something to say what Netflix thinks I want to watch, even though if it's not I don't know. It's just, it's this, the way that your experience can be shaped by AI that kind of, that aspect. I don't know that it's like creepy. It's just sort of, I mean, I sort of, I'm so used to it. Like, I'm so used to the fact, like, I feel as if I've become like jaded about the whole thing. Like, if I'm looking at some website and think, should I click on that? Or no, I'm going to see that pair of shoes then for the next 3 months every time I go to a website. Do I even like, and then I just don't click because I don't want to see those shoes, you know?
Right. Yeah. It's amazing how much noise it generates that we, it just becomes another thing that we have to ignore in favor of trying to figure out the old fashioned way what we actually want.
Exactly. Exactly. Then I hate myself for like, if I ever, if there is some sort of errand type thing I need to buy and I'm reminded of it from an ad, and it's like, it doesn't mean that I didn't need it, but it's like the ad told, oh, I don't know. It's weird. But you know, even here in Canada, it's not potato sack communism exactly. So whatever, I'll be at the Aritzia sooner or later, whatever they, you know, whatever I might vow otherwise. Yeah, I don't know. I feel like both relieved to have paired off pre-apps and like I probably shouldn't be so dystopian about what it all means, because it is just, I mean, I think more people, potentially meeting more people could be a good thing in the abstract. But yeah, I don't know. I don't think math is going to figure out who in the world is the most beautiful.
Right. Yeah, I agree. I mean, even if we, you know, tried to create an infallible system, I think that the results ultimately would not, you know, be things that people would accept, even if they wanted to accept them, unless we all, right, you know, kind of collectively get together and decide that the app or the algorithm is our new god. And, you know, we're going to align our aesthetic tastes and desires with whatever the algorithm tells us to do. I think we're stuck for the moment.
For sure. I mean, I think it does. I do think it's probably already affected my social life, the way when I was on Facebook more, the way seeing certain stories more than others and all of that. Yeah, I don't think there's necessarily opting out, no matter one's relationship status and so forth. I don't know. It's what's coming.
I forgot to put the dog away this time. Hey, buddy, please be quiet.
Well, it's headphones, so it's unlikely to set off my dog.
That's good.
We'll see.
Yeah,
we'll see.
Although sometimes they can like sense each other, I think.
Well, I mean, my dog definitely knows we're going to be going out of town in a day or two. And yeah, quite a mood. So we'll see what comes of this. So do you have further thoughts on artificial intelligence in its problematic and unproblematic?
Gosh, no. I mean, I think I've rambled. I think I've rambled enough.
No, not rambled. But so I think we have to talk about the meme. And when I say the meme, so there's always a meme, right? And because there's some lag between when we record and when it will actually appear, you will be like, oh, well, that meme is like that. There's probably a whole new meme by then.
So the thing is, I will say, because I had somebody send me part of this meme this morning, that the normie person world is only just, I think, catching up to this stuff.
Right.
Like, you know, a week to 3 to 4 days after the two online.
But is feminine chaos audience normie or not? Not normie.
I don't know.
Wait, in the comments if you are.
Please tell us. Are you a normie?
So the meme. Well, I think the way, what I would trace this to, okay, what I would trace this meme to, and I'm going to just try to find again when this was from, because this tweet, it was a tweet on a website known as Twitter. April 17th. It feels like this was 100 years ago.
Oh, gosh. Yeah.
But it wasn't. It was only April 17th. It, as of now, has 19,700 retweets, 130.8. Sorry, now something just happened. It has...
It's still going viral.
What is going on here? 130,800 likes. Okay. I don't know how many replies because I don't see that somehow in this window. Anyway, by the author and writer Dana Schwartz. Okay. You ready for it?
I'm ready.
Okay.
Hit me.
All caps. Every woman in my life. And then not all caps anymore. juggling three jobs, does yoga, cooks, goes to therapy, remembers everyone's birthday. And then again, all caps, their boyfriends. And then again, not all caps. Once almost made a dinner reservation, but turns out the place was closed. Okay, that's it. That's
went
the tweet.
Massively viral.
Massively viral. Has
and spawned
parody,
like a whole yeah.
parody genre, which if I would have had a different sort of week, maybe I would have put together one of those. But yeah, people were kind of mocking it. People were reproducing it in sort of earnest. Somehow Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's boyfriend got looped into it because, I mean, oh, she's God. Clearly a very successful millennial. She's a millennial, right?
Mm-hmm.
If we're millennials, but she's like
30. She's even more millennial than we are. Yeah.
We're like fake millennials, technical older. Millennials or something.
Elder millennials.
Yeah. And she has a boyfriend who in at least one photograph looks like he could pass as a slacker. I don't know. But then another photograph.
I'm just going to like briefly step in to defend this poor guy who was compared to a bin raccoon, which I mean.
Okay. So this is by somebody who I find generally excellent on Twitter.
Oh,
and
she's great.
I think she probably feels like she stepped into something there. It was one of these whole awful Twitter episodes where one person makes an ill thought through tweet and then some huge chunk of the internet tells them that they are evil. And the poor guy also, he should not have been. Yeah.
Right. I mean, this was like, it was a still
bed.
Or like a screenshot from a documentary that he was in where he was doing, like he was taking a selfie on screen. And so, yeah, he looked dopey. And it was at a point in the, you know, because he was like helping out with her campaign where, you know, they were both like on all cylinders. And so neither one of them was like grooming the way that maybe they
right,
would.
Right. He had kind of a scruffy beard.
Yeah.
He?
And it was orange, you know, scruffy orange.
Because he's got red hair.
Right. Which, I mean, you know, maybe this is a form of prejudice that we're a little less tolerant of a scruffy orange beard on a ginger man.
That seems to be a societal thing. I have really no feeling about this, but apparently it's a thing that like redheaded men and beards, I don't know. But yeah, I mean, but it was just weird how it like became suddenly all over the internet was this thing about the, how all of these amazing women, millennial women specifically, are with all of these mediocre, pathetic boyfriends.
Right. And then soon it became not just about their boyfriends, but about millennial women versus millennial men in general.
Yeah. And then it sort of became even bigger and became this, I don't know the publishing timeline of this, of course, because I do not work there. But at Harper's Bazaar, then there's this article. I need to find who the author was of this. Melanie Hamlet. An article by Melanie Hamlet appeared then on May 2nd called Men Have No Friends and Women Bear the Burden, which is, oh boy, it's like this weird article that's, if you go further into it, it's basically an article about how some men have trouble in interpersonal relationships and benefit from these all-male support groups, which is nice and kind of like a weird topic for a women's fashion magazine. But we can talk, and in fact, I insist we talk about women, what women's fashion magazines, especially online, cover these days and how it's rarely connected in any way to anything women's fashion.
Yeah.
But then it had this weird framework and not just the headline, because headlines can be weird, but like the whole intro was basically about how actually the real problem with men having a harder time socially is that this affects women negatively. And it also just was very sort of universalizing, like men have no friends. Women have lots of friends. Women have to act as their men's therapists. while also doing all of the work and being amazing, and men are terrible, and this is all ages and all social classes and blah, blah, blah. But of course, it's harder for people of color, but it's everybody. It's everybody. It's everybody. It's
like, I mean, it was like that Onion headline where it was like, humanity wiped out, women hardest hit, you know? Like,
yes, it didn't, I am prepared to believe aspects of this. I'm prepared to believe that men have a harder time on average socially than women. I'm not prepared to believe that that means that things are worse for women in that front. It seems like an area where it would be then harder for men. I do think, and this is where we can perhaps debate, that grooming standards for women are, depends on the subculture. There are some where they're very high for everybody, some where they're not terribly high for everybody, but they're in the kind of mainstream North American subculture, whatever culture. It does seem like the standards are higher on women than men. I think that's probably true. But that doesn't mean that life standards in all realms, like I think probably the pressure to have an impressive career is still higher on men than women. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, why don't we, you know, maybe we should start by trying to be charitable to this article. You know, what parts of it, if any, do you think make a valid point?
Well, I think I actually don't find it so difficult to be charitable to it, because I think it's something happened where it got sort of formulated into the clickbait, because I think there probably are, in fact, I'm sure there are men who kind of rely a lot more kind of emotionally on the women they're with than vice versa, and that could be draining for the woman, even if it's ultimately more dangerous for the man, because if the couple splits up, obviously, where does that leave the man? And I think I didn't know that there were these men's support groups, and maybe that's useful for someone to learn about. I don't know if they're reading Harper's Bazaar, but in the internet age, why not?
They'll find out about it from their wife, who did read Harper's Bazaar.
Exactly. I think that what I felt uncharitable towards was just the kind of, and I think this has to do with this sort of new, privilege aware or woke or however one wants to put it, age of sort of all media, where you can go to an article on something like Harper's Bazaar or Vogue, not just Teen Vogue, these websites, and it's just this kind of Mad Libs of like social justice terminology and sort of not very thought through arguments about how actually things are worse for the following demographics. And I don't even dispute that things are in general worse for the demographics in question. It's just, as an article, it's kind of like, it's not necessarily even demonstrating that, which this one I don't think was.
Well, something I found interesting was after this article ran, you know, it obviously garnered an enormous amount of reaction. But one of the things that people started saying, and it was women mostly giving this kind of feedback, suggesting that, like, you know, these men's groups that were meeting, you know, where men could talk about their feelings, these were not a good thing. In fact, they were highly suspicious of them, because God only knows what kind of stuff the men were getting up to in these groups or what they might be saying, which kind of, you know, it made me think about how, I mean, in like centuries past, men did have, you know, these sex segregated spaces where they could retreat, you know, they could go to their club or, you know, go to their poker night. And it was seen, but these were seen as toxic spaces, you know, where that were rife with toxic masculinity. And it's almost as though there's this catch-22 of wanting men to form these groups and like create spaces where it's just them and they're reaching out to each other for support or, you know, to commiserate or whatever. But then we don't like what goes on in there. We don't like the way, you know, the way they're doing it. So, you know, it has to stop.
Right. Well, it's like the locker room talk.
Right.
Thing. I mean, I guess I think the problem that my own feminism would have with potentially with certain men's only spaces is if that's where like decisions, hiring decisions and such, and like the if that's where business is getting done, is in these right. men's only clubs.
I would say,
but
like,
in the sense of like the locker room, whatever, that maybe the men are objectifying women in those spaces. It's like, well, maybe the women are objectifying men in the women's spaces, because guess what?
Oh, no, they are.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, it makes me think, I have to be careful about how much I, you know, how much I say about this, but my father-in-law has like a, you know, a standing, or had a standing golf date that would end with everyone kind of gathering in like the sauna or whatever to play cards. And I would hear, you know, when my husband went to join this outing, if we were down visiting for the holidays or whatever, I would hear a little bit about, you know, what kinds of conversations occurred in this space, you know, and all these guys are in like their 70s. And that it was, in fact, the kind of supportive environment where, you know, there would be things discussed, like, you know, feelings or whatever, you know, the personal, the kind of therapeutic stuff that supposedly is, you know, beneficial for men to talk about, that they've been encouraged not to talk about by society. But there was also a lot of grossness, you know, there was a lot of like body nasty, like maybe some objectification of women, you know, maybe just some generally gross stuff going on in there. And you know,
my poodle objects to the objectification.
Right. Your poodle would not be invited as, no. you know, as a female poodle to this poker / golf sauna outing. But, you know, I think that there's this idea of locker room talk, you know, that sometimes maybe this is in fact how men communicate with each other. And
well, I think it's how people communicate with each other, possibly in single sex spaces, and mm-hmm. that the notion, it's just because it's more familiar what the male version of this is. But I think when women get together, all sorts of things are discussed as well. It's just less sort of discussed generally. It's just less known. I don't know if there's a less
for
body.
Like, Sex and the City was all about this. I mean, that entire show was about women like getting together.
It was, but then people would always say, but they're really just, it's supposed to be gay men, but they're played by women because of society and all of this, that it's not really, women do not really talk like that. But
I've never heard that.
That was what people would always say about it, that like this was really like supposed to be more like how gay men are, and that women are just, I don't know, just thinking about, I don't know, thinking of England. I don't know. I don't know.
It's all sunshine and daisies.
I mean, but if I can bring this a little back to the meme thing, what I think is just the way when I saw this article, there was this passage in it that made me really think of the meme, which was somewhere, I'm not going to find it right now, so I'm just going to say that it was basically something about how like every woman has her act completely together and men just don't.
Right.
And it just seemed like the whole point of the article was that it both seemed to exaggerate how sort of disastrous men are, and in this weird, potentially patronizing, certainly overgeneralizing way, exaggerate how together women have it, and also sort of, I don't know, like, is it, if you're spending a ton of your time on self-care, you know, loosely defined, is there a threshold past which that's maybe too much time for, you know what I mean? Like it seemed to be a few issues, and then it pathologizes sort of interdependence, which people were also kind of parodying or making fun of a bit on Twitter. But this notion that it's a bad thing for a man to like rely emotionally on his wife and you know, and vice versa. Like, yeah, maybe not. Maybe that's okay for couples to kind of rely on.
Yeah. I mean, the idea that women, you know, that women don't do that, that we all like go outside our romantic relationships primarily for emotional support. I mean, that doesn't ring true for me personally.
For me either. And I think what it did though, it seems like you're in some kind of like antiquated sitcom realm, both in the meme and in that article, where yes. the women chat on the phone with their girlfriends and girlfriends in the very like platonic pre-awareness sense, you know, mm-hmm. not polyamorous.
I think everyone gets it. We're
yes,
good.
Yes. Okay. But, you know, when women are just like chatting on the phone with their girlfriends and men are just, you know, like, I don't even know, just sort of these useless on the couch playing the video games that's, you know, and that like there's somehow, I mean, it's like some weird amalgam of different cliches, but all amounting to, I mean, it is very much the whole like Seth Rogen knocked up world.
Yes, I was thinking it's like, it's very much like the Judd Apatow world.
Yeah,
but what I was thinking is how much that as a construct was a response to an older variety of humor that was kind of predicated on like, you know, men be like this and women be like
yes.
this. And it was like, you know, like the Rodney Dangerfield kind of
exactly.
story. And it's like the kind of jokes that I always think of as like take my wife please humor, mm-hmm. Where, you know, it would be male, you know, comedians or whatever, kind of cracking wise about like the Little Women and how, you know, oh, they're flighty and like, I make the money she spends it, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So like now we've got this obvious shift in, you know, how everyone occupies their various gender roles in society and, you know, women are in the workforce. And to me, this seems like in part an evolution of that same kind of, I mean, I would have like called it emotive humor, and I guess now it's mm-hmm. more like a meme.
And it's presenting itself as social justice though now, which
yes,
is what's so weird.
That's the weird thing.
That's
about
what's
it.
So weird, because why, so that's what I can't figure out. And that's why I think I'm kind of obsessed with this, is how did it become this women are like so, men are like so. And I guess, I mean, the idea is that it's patriarchy. I guess the idea of why this could be social justice-y is that like patriarchy demands a lot more of women than of men would be the idea. But I guess it's somehow, there's something about how like, this, both in the meme and in the article, it's somehow the more you say it, the less it makes sense. And there, it's true in certain specific realms. Like I can understand this when there are discussions of like studies about how many hours are spent doing this or that type of household labor. Mm-hmm. I can understand, you know, there, and all of that. But like this, to say that it just seems like putting women on this kind of pedestal, like all women, every last woman on this pedestal. It gets like it's kind of in keeping with this sort of Me Too moment of that, like the only women who exist are like in the sort of in the zeitgeist are these kind of like super together young women who are also attractive. You know what I mean? Like that, mm-hmm. that's women. And like somebody on Twitter who I think uses some kind of like long pseudonym with a lot of numbers was saying something about how it's like specifically women who are using Tinder in Brooklyn. Have these complaints, like young women
yeah.
who use Tinder in Brooklyn have this complaint, and that it's, they're universalizing it. I mean, it could just be something as simple as this has become a meme because women who work in media are more likely to be in dating situations where there are more women than men,
mm-hmm.
you know, in the straight dating pool, and that therefore there's just more competition among the women than would
right.
be the case in like Silicon Valley or something.
Yeah. I guess what's interesting about it to me is this idea that like, you know, if we live in a patriarchy where women are kind of helpless in the face of this, you know, like mass wave of male failure, you know, and nothing can be done about it. It's bizarre that the conversation is so dominated by this one particular topic all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I guess the part of it that I find very alienating, and stay tuned because I am, when not on maternity leave, writing about this, but it's all very in the air at the moment. But this notion of that, this assumption that the typical woman hates not sexism, but men, and is like men, this just terrible men. How could anybody, like, oh, what an unfortunate thing. I don't think that's shared by, I know for a fact it is not shared by every woman on the planet. I don't think it's as widely shared as the Twitter might have one believe, or as the zeitgeist has.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that, you know, even for the people who are saying this on Twitter, that
they're not living it. No, they're certainly not living. No, I mean, it's not the end of heterosexuality has not taken place, and then I think that's something that it just feels disingenuous. It feels like it's a mood, it's a trend, and it's not, you know, like that there are, it's not that there aren't real complaints about sexism in the mix, but this notion that men are the worst and that women offline, not when tweeting kind of like an in-joke about it, actually think this, I think a lot of men take it very seriously and get kind of hurt.
Mm-hmm.
Where they don't have to, because it isn't really so serious. But yeah, I think it isn't quite as serious.
Yeah. I mean, when you say they don't have to, it's like...
No, I mean, it's true. Also, but I don't blame them, though.
I mean, I was going to say, like, I think, you know, were there sort of similar memes going around directed at women that we would all feel pretty crappy about it. So, you know.
That's true.
maybe the solution is just for us all to maybe, like, dial it back a little.
Dialing it back is always a good idea, but before we dial it back, I think we have to get to our final topic,
which is sure. Basic bitch bookstores.
Basic bitch bookstores. yes.
Kat, so you put alliterative. It, well.
It basic but, bitch bookstores. So this is my favorite silly topic in a while, and I have a knack for closing whichever window I'm trying to keep open.
Well, I will say that I think that you should, you know, do the explainer portion on this one because it is based in Canada, right? So,
oh, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, so I'm gonna forget about looking for the link about it. Basically, I think her name is Heather Reisman, if possible. Anyway, is the head of this bookstore chain in Canada that has recently, called Indigo, that has recently opened a branch, I guess, in New Jersey in a mall. I am expert in Canada bookstores, New Jersey malls, basic bitches, all of these. This is like...
Could not be more in your wheelhouse.
And then it gets to be about internet comments, and I'm just like in heaven. So, so I used to live in New Jersey where what is there but malls, right? So basically... my dog just rolled her eyes, I'm sure, at my saying basically. I did not even intend to that pun. So basically, there was just a big article in the Times about how Indigo has arrived in the States, this Canadian bookstore chain, and about how the concept involves pairing actually it's a pretty great book selection. It's something like Barnes & Noble in the States, but I would say, having pretty recent comparison, better book selection. With knickknacks, right? You know, like coffee is in the ones here. I don't know about in the one in the States. I don't remember. But there's throw pillows, motivational slogans, like the sign above my head that says, no peddlers. No, not like that. But
motivational. All I saw was poodle, spelled P.
Oh, no. That's a German poodle book. Yeah, there's that too. No, so probably none of these sorts of knickknacks, but the like, the sort of knickknacks where if, for example, you are staging a home in the hopes that someone will purchase it, they would not offend anybody, if right. That makes sense. Like that sort of thing. Also like scented candles, vegan leather purses, some of which are quite nice. Reading socks, which is a concept that apparently comes from Margaret Atwood, which I had not realized, but if I ever see her again in the Whole Foods over here, I once did spot her in the Whole Foods over here. I'll have to ask her about that. My like only celebrity sighting here, I think. But yeah, so basically like crap that might be sold in a bookstore, like that's for gifts, or that sort of thing. But not just crap, like things, you know, that are also kind of practical. So, like, the baby section has stuff that I've bought, like, because it's useful. So the problem for a huge number of New York Times commenters is that the knickknacks that this bookstore sells tilt feminine, which they do. And oh my goodness, were there amazing and like juicy, really funny comments to this article. Okay. So people really seem to, these commenters did not, oh no, I've opened Keynote rather than click back on Zoom. That's really useful. I'm definitely going to give you all a lecture.
Just to briefly derail, I mean, women do make up a bigger percentage.
It said 60%. Right? It said 60% in that article. So it made sense as a marketing move. What was strange to me was that men, all men, not just the few who commented on the few in the grand scheme of things, who commented on this Times article, but like every single man. No, men totally shop at this bookstore. They had these towers of the Jordan Peterson book clearly flying off the shelves.
Interesting.
This is not, you go into it. It is not like you're going into some sort of candle shop. You know, it's not like a candle and chocolates shop. It's, you know, it's a bookstore. And it just the knickknacks. And it's probably women buying most of the gifts and things like that. Somebody on Twitter had said something about like teachers' gifts. Is that kind of, it is that sort of thing. But the comments are just funny. So one person commented, and a bunch were just objecting to the whole concept of a bookstore, okay?
That was something else entirely.
Well, they're related. So somebody...
No, called, I mean, it was amazing.
Oh, like, yes, it certainly was. So somebody who calls himself or herself, or themselves, Iron Man, commented, "The price is always right at my public library." Okay, this is a response to the existence of a bookstore. I go to the library all the time. It's fine. I don't want to, like, ban bookstores. And then there was this other one that, so these were the ones that had nothing to do with gender particular, well, maybe Iron Man, but this one is from somebody else, Laurel in New Jersey, commented, "Obviously the target sale is a female of a certain age group and a particular socioeconomic group. My friends and I fit that targeted group. However, we prefer keeping our money in our own pockets. Thank you. The bottom line is important to us. My friends and I shop thrift stores for good titles, then pass around the books until we've all had an opportunity to read them. When we are done with them, we donate them to assisted living communities, church rummage sales, libraries, etc. It works for us. Now, Kat, as an author, as a fellow author, wouldn't it be just wonderful the whole...
Boy, oh boy. I'm going to starve to death because of people like Laurel.
don't you just admire... But what I love about that comment... Okay, so there are other ones. I'll go on my feminist rant in a moment, but first, just a moment about Laurel here. What's amazing about this comment is that it's like phrased as if like she's expecting that sort of, that like pat on, she's expecting praise for it. Like, good for you saving those pennies that you've made it clear you have, but choose not to spend on books. Good for you, Laurel.
I'm just gonna actually briefly, tangentially rant about this because it's amazing to me that this is an attitude, it's not actually that rare, like, that like, I'm too good to spend money on books. And it's the only medium that people seem to have this kind of sense of entitlement about, that like, you know, the books should be, you know, they should be free to me. And almost always it, if you kind of like scratch the surface of that, it's, and people should create these books for me, you know, not as a livelihood, but out of, you know, a pure passion for writing and providing this story to me. You know, it's just bizarre. I mean, you would never see somebody being like, and I mean, it's a more widely accepted thing that if you want to see, you know, for instance, more of a certain kind of movie, that it's important to go out to the theater and to, you know, to spend the money on your ticket so that, you know, the people who make these products know that there's a demand for them and so that they make more that you can then, you know, spend your money on.
Yeah.
If people were like, "I prefer to keep my money in my pocket, thank you very much," and, you know, went out and got like a DVD of the Avengers and then went and had like a showing in their living room and then gave it to their friends to show in their living room and they donated it all to an assisted living facility. You're not going to end up with like multiple Avengers movies. I mean, if everybody does this.
Well, I mean, I think it's just, it's like, I think other things get pirated, but I think what's weird with books is, like you say, it's this, that people who write them and want to sell them have some nerve. Like, often there's this sort of, like, if somebody has, like, an op-ed in a newspaper because they have a book out, it'll be like, I think they're trying to sell that book.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, they probably are if they, like, retweet some kind of, like, if somebody puts in your social media that their band is having a show and you're not interested, you don't go to the show.
Yeah.
If they put on social media that they have written a book, it's like they're trying to sell their book. And it's like, well, yeah, probably they are trying to do that.
Yes, they are. It's the idea, like, yeah. How dare you think that what you do for a living has any value?
Well, I know that if I Google my own name, which I've done before in my life, I see the pirated version of my book. Like, I understand. And it also is frustrating apart from everything else. Like, I have no idea how many people actually, like, read my book because, like, that I'll never know. And it's just these, like, things floating around. Maybe, like, 10 people have illegally downloaded it. Maybe 10 trillion. No. I'm thinking probably about 3 or 4. But, yeah, I mean, I find that whole aspect of it, I mean, it does help authors to get books from the library as well. But this seems to go further in the whole thing of, like, basically, if this book didn't just, like, happen to be on the stoop with a free sign on it, it's not the book for me type approach. And it's like, you would then end up with a lot of copies of I Am Charlotte Simmons. That was always the one on stoops for a while.
Interesting. But everybody bought it and then left it out
in Park Slope circa like 2008. It was just the stoop book.
Fascinating.
But I have to bring the topic back to these comments though, because it was really, really special. Most though were, comments from men, at least so identifying themselves in the comments. Okay. So one is a man who comments, I'm in the gender that Indigo doesn't target. Fine with me. I'll keep on shopping at some other bookstore, whatever. Okay. And then another, as a male, I find the store kind of obnoxious now. The whole place is designed for someone who would buy Girl Wash Your Face or subscribe to Fab Fit Fun boxes. Obviously, this person knows a lot more about basic culture than, let's say, even I do. If you are not into the aesthetic of having kitschy sayings written on all your goods, it is basically all trash. The only reason I shop there is that it's basically the only game in town or one in a convenient location for me. So wait a second. So this is somebody who acknowledges that it's a good bookstore. He goes there because it's a bookstore or good enough bookstore.
But
the fact that they sell other things too is a problem, and specifically which other things. And then there's this, this one. Well, hooray for all us book lovers, but as a guy who reads every day, it does not seem to me that Ms. Reisman gives a rip about getting me or any other guys into her stores. So the complaint is not that she doesn't, this woman does not sell books. It's that there is this other crap there. And I screenshotted a million of these. There's one more that I have to because it's amazing. Sorry. Fred here, I'm not going to say his last name, but you can all find comments, whatever. With respect, and as a book and bookstore lover, not me. This is a Times pick, mind you, okay? Mm-hmm. It probably doesn't matter. I am an individual, speak for no group, eat red meat, don't drink tea, use any brand of soap that gets me clean, have no interest in lifestyle books or brands, and I'm happy to do my own curating. I recognize that I am not the target demo. I do wish them luck. We do need brick and mortar bookstores. Perhaps the success one will encourage to others to try, some of whom may be closer to my tastes. In the meantime, there is always the public library. So thank you, Fred.
Clearly we're like missing a real kind of golden goose opportunity to do a spinoff called Indiguy, where it's, all like leather goods and like, candle-scented like beard oil.
And, oh my goodness! All those things that are in the gift guides for men,
right? Yeah, leather, whiskey, knives.
Those things you put in whiskey to cool it that are made out of like cement or something that they sell in like a museum gift shop.
Oh,
those like cubes.
Yeah.
No one in my household drinks like whiskey, so I don't know what it is, but something maybe to keep the whiskey cold.
Right. Yeah. Something, yeah. I think something like that, you know, the kind of thing that, yeah, like that you give to a man who you don't, who you've no idea what he actually likes. So
exactly. Exactly.
Here's a not ice cube for your whiskey.
I mean, I tend to get my husband gifts from Indigo Books.
So what you're saying is your husband loves kitschy throw pillows.
Definitely.
Shine like a star.
That you might, what you see here is totally unrepresented. The rest is just completely, I guess what fascinated me about this was, one, this notion that it's like this pair. Okay. So it's this pair notion that aesthetics shouldn't matter and that it's just about the books, with this weird fetishization of a certain type of bookstore where whatever aesthetic there is, like this whole thing of like, I like an old dusty bookstore where it looks like this and this and this. It's like,
right.
That's also an aesthetic choice. That's also an aesthetic preference. That's also not about reading specifically.
But people seem to think that it is. That it's like, you know, it's somehow cheap.
Like the smell of the books. And if you read the book on the computer or in a store that also sells scented candles or, yeah.
Right. And then there's like a whole other category of conversation that we could have about people who are like, I just love the smell of a binding or whatever, you know, so that they won't read ebooks.
Yes, that's, oh boy. That's
as though it's not really reading.
These things are all, I think, very related. Like this notion that somebody's notion that they are like a better person because their aesthetic tastes are one way or another, as if they've somehow transcended the aesthetic or transcended the sort of material, you know, which they have not. But I find the whole, like, I guess the whole basicness aspect of it, it's just sort of fascinating that, like, if this is, it is, I know it, it's like, there's a bunch of them in Toronto. I know these bookstores well. They're nice bookstores. They're fine. They're not, you know, the only bookstores here. There are also used bookstores. I shop there as well. I also go to the library, go to, you know, all these places, and they're all fine. But like this notion that the existence in the bookstore of more women-oriented knickknacks prevents men from going in. Like the sheer number of comments that are like, I then cannot enter that space.
What
do they think is going to happen if they go in? It's like they act as if like it's going into some sort of like, you know,
admittedly it is the worst when you go into a store and the next thing you know, like a throw pillow has wrapped itself around your neck and you're being strangled to death.
That's true.
Off.
And then how are you going to get a book?
Right.
It's hard to shop for books when that happens. Or when one of those like signs that might be up, like falls on your head. When you enter. Yeah.
Right. Absolutely. Suddenly, you know, you go into a fugue state, you walk out with 17 candles that smell like a cookie and no books.
And none of the copies of 12 Rules for Life.
Right.
They sell at Indigo by the truckload. Yeah, I don't know. I just found the whole thing so strange. This reaction was so, it was this mix. I guess what got to me about it was this mix of this weird, like, fetishization of the idea of books minus materialism, which in turn segues into the whole thing of like, and screw authors who actually need to make money through the selling of books.
A lot going on there.
Yeah. And then the whole weird gender thing where it's just these men love books so much.
But not enough to.
That they can't buy them or even look at them near throw pillows. Their love of books is so pure.
I really wonder if there's something going on, like if this is the manifestation of an issue with this aesthetic that's coming from somewhere else in their lives. Like, did a terrible ex-girlfriend really love these kind of like kitschy basic throw pillows and you know, it brings up bad memories?
I have no sense of how common, I mean, it must be. So I've seen this aesthetic out in the world, so to speak, two places. One is when looking at apartments, condos that have been staged in Toronto will have this aesthetic. Mm-hmm. There's always the same Audrey Hepburn poster, always the same one, always the same sort of motivational slogans. You know what I mean? Like, it's a very specific.
Just carting the poster from one apartment to another, probably.
Oh, no, no. It's like, oh, yeah. Oh, well, for sure. Yeah. Sorry, I'm a little out of it. But yeah. So I've seen it there, but I've also seen it the very first episode. This could be its own feminine cast, so I won't go into too much, but of the Marie Kondo show.
Yeah.
Woman who had that, like, sort of, it was clearly the woman who had decorated there, and it was that aesthetic for sure. And I have not seen this in, like, friends' homes or anything.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very specific. I've seen it a lot on HGTV. It's like, I mean, Joanna Gaines, it's her aesthetic. Like, you know, she always uses, like, you know, she has she has artisan made, like, kitschy printed pressed steel signs or whatever. But it's true that this is not like, actually, it just occurred to me, why do they sell so much of this stuff when it, or do we just not swim in the right circles, you know, for, to be,
I think it's a lot of it is stuff like gifts where it's like, it's, and that's why it's for gifts and for like apartment staging. Cause it's not going to offend anybody. Like every single thing in my apartment would probably, like, in one way or another, require, if nothing else, require an explanation. These things do not require any explanation, you know, like, they're, it's a canvas, you know, even if it's like clutter, it's still like, it's not a specific, you know, it's just like, it's just sort of decor. I don't know.
I guess.
Like, I don't know if there, I don't know if there are people who have, whose homes look like an indigo. You know, it might just be you collect here and there things from it that kind of get mixed up with your stuff and stop looking so basic in the, I don't know.
In context. Yeah, yeah. I'm sort of like looking around at like what's around me. Do I have anything super basic? I don't think I really.
I mean, I have a lot of IKEA. Is that basic? I mean, it's basic in the other sense.
I don't know. Does it, is it IKEA with like Pinterest hacks? Because that would be pretty, in fact, pretty basic.
No,
you just assembled it. You just put it together. That's not basic.
Yeah, afraid not. Yeah, I don't know. I guess I just found the whole thing, like the, this article that seems sort of neither here nor there, like, okay, there's a new bookstore from Canada that's now in the States, got such angry comments. And I love when something very, very sort of bland gets a lot of really angry comments. It's my favorite internet. So yeah, I was happy. I mean,
I can't wait to see. Can't wait to see what kind of angry comments we get on this bland episode about the bland article.
Oh, goodness knows. Well, please tell us all of your thoughts about all of it.
Yeah,
in the comments for sure. but you will, whether or not we ask. All right. So has this been another feminine chaos?
This has been another feminine chaos. We'll see you all next time.
Until next time.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.